Cassie McCullough with you on Life Matters. And a warning now for listeners who might have young children around. We're about to discuss a death and some of the details may be disturbing. Well, almost 6 years ago, 24-year-old Phoebe Handsjuk was found motionless in the garbage room of the Melbourne apartment block that she lived in with her boyfriend, Anthony Hampel. She'd somehow entered the garbage chute on the 12th floor and had suffered horrendous injuries on her fall. Initially, the case was decided to be a suicide by police, but after a petitioning by the family, a coronial inquest went ahead. It found that misadventure had occurred, that it wasn't necessarily a suicide and it wasn't necessarily foul play. It was somewhere in between. The coroner, notably, did not take the option of leaving an open finding. But still, the case attracts a lot of attention. In recent times, you might have seen the story being told on 60 Minutes. The Age newspaper has been covering it. It has released a podcast. The first couple of episodes are online. And Robin Bowles has written a book about it. Now, she's the author of 13 books, which include one about the toddler Jaden Leskie and another about British backpacker Peter Falconio. Robin's with us now to talk to us about her book, Into the Darkness. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Cassie.
For listeners who don't know this story, can you just give us the outline of what happened to Phoebe on the 2nd of December 2010?
Certainly. Phoebe was a very beautiful young girl. She was 24, as you said, living with her 40-year-old partner in a wealthy apartment building in St Kilda Road. And on a quiet day where there was nothing that might have predicted that she would take her own life, she allegedly climbed into a very small rubbish chute that people in the apartment block used to throw their rubbish down into a compactor, and slid feet first down into the compactor, through the compactor, onto the floor. And she then crawled around the rubbish room, leaving a trail of blood behind her from her severed foot, and even managed to reach the door. And there were hand marks in blood on the door, which was terribly distressing when I heard that at the inquest. And she failed to get out, and she bled to death, basically. And everybody who knew her just could not believe that she could have done this herself. And there were a number of reasons for that. The main one was that there were three family birthdays coming up. Her brother, the next night, she'd planned to help her mother decorate the house. He was 18. And then her grandfather was going to be 70 the week after. And her best friend was having a birthday also in a couple of weeks' time. And it was just unimaginable to her family that she would have done that at this time of her, you know, life, even though she did have some issues with alcohol and depression.
As you say, the details are disturbing, and the case has disturbed the lives of many, her family, her friends, but also the people who were involved in the immediate aftermath. The concierge of the hotel who found her body, the attending police officers, the ambulance officers have all suffered a lot because of what might be seen as a bit of a mix-up about the process immediately after her discovery.
Oh, I think it was more than a mix-up. I think it was a balls-up, if I can use that expression on the ABC. But one of the reasons that I became interested in this story was, first of all, there was an article in The Age about Phoebe who had allegedly committed suicide, and the media, as you know, rarely covers suicide stories. So I was quite intrigued by this, and that was what prompted me to attend the inquest. I didn't know the family and I didn't know the full story at the time. But what I found out at the inquest was that the normally scrupulously tidy apartment that Phoebe shared with Aunt Hampel was quite disarranged. There was a broken glass on the floor, and there was blood on the architrave of the study room and on the mouse of the computer, which later turned out to be Phoebe's blood. And then there was also her blood in the 12th floor refuse room. And it did look initially as if there may have been a struggle and that somebody had put her in the chute. The other terribly disturbing thing was that because the police thought that it could have been a murder on the night they attended, they sealed off the refuse room as a crime scene. And when the ambulance officers arrived, they weren't allowed to go near Phoebe at all, her inert body. And, of course, the family has nightmares about the fact that she may not have even been dead at that time, because nobody knows what time she went down the chute. She was found at about 7:10 by the concierge, as you said, who absolutely spun out, as you would. And the police arrived within minutes, and so did the ambulance. But they weren't able to go near the possible body, but might have been, she may have been still alive, because the police considered it a crime scene. And the ambulance officer who attended has told me herself that, you know, it just stays with her that if she could have got to her, at least they would have known if her body was warm or cold, and that could have given a clue as to when she actually went down the chute.
It seems that every fact in this case can have an argument either way, either side of it. There is one explanation and another equally convincing one on just about every step of the way. But tell us about Phoebe and her life.
Well, Phoebe was the oldest child of Len and Natalie Handschuck. She was a beautiful little girl. She has two younger brothers in fairly quick succession after her, who absolutely idolised her. She was always a bit of a free spirit. She went to a Rudolf Steiner school, which encourages that sort of free spirit attitude to life. And she was a pretty good student. And she was universally loved. All her friends loved her. She lived a pretty charmed life. Her parents split up in her early teens, and she got in with a crowd of girls who were all quite good looking and had money, and they were experimenting with drugs. And Phoebe became a bit wild at that time. She ran away from home, and she was away for 6 weeks, I think. And when she came back, she left the Rudolf Steiner School and went to a different school, but finished school. And then she went into the hospitality and services industries, working in those areas. She had a few boyfriends before she met Aunt Hampel, and most of them were older than she was. And then she met Aunt and moved in with him about 18 months before she died. But it wasn't a strictly de facto relationship, because he was charging her rent, and she did contribute to the household expenses in her own way as well. He considered it a de facto relationship, but Phoebe's parents didn't really consider it one. They thought that she was living with him, but that was the source of quite a lot of friction later on after she died, for a number of reasons.
Yes, this was the beginning of some conflict between the two families.
Yes, exactly.
So Phoebe's father is a psychiatrist, and her grandfather, Lorne Campbell, is a retired detective. They found the details of her death obviously distressing, but they also felt that suicide was not the most likely outcome. And Lorne went about doing some research of his own.
Well, he conducted a full investigation, actually. He was a retired detective. He was in the police force for 30-odd years. And he really did a very thorough investigation, and he made the results of that investigation available to the coroner and the police. And he did a lot of investigating that the police probably should have done, including testing whether Phoebe could have even entered the chute properly and fallen down, which they didn't bother to do. And to do that, he had the support of the chute manufacturer, who made up a fake section of chute and with a drop down to a mattress on the floor. And he got two of Phoebe's friends to come and try to climb into the chute and fall down. One was able to, the other one, her shoulders were too broad. But it was very obvious that the arms had to be behind her head when she went in through this very small hole. It's only 22 centimetres wide. So her arms trailed behind her. And yet in the coroner's finding, he said that Phoebe tried to break her fall by using her hands to slow herself down. Now, there were no dirty marks on Phoebe's hands whatsoever, and the inside of the chute is filthy. It's already been sampled. And she wouldn't have been able to get her hands down to her sides in the 30 metre drop she would have been travelling about 85 kilometres an hour. So, you know, she just wouldn't have had time to do that. So that was an experiment that Lawn did to demonstrate to the police that, you know, she must have been put in, even though it was possible for the girls to climb in with great difficulty. But Phoebe had a blood alcohol of 0.16 at the time, and that's three times the driving limit. So she would have found enormous difficulty to try and climb up into this chute, which is a metre above the ground.
Although she did also have still knocks in her system.
She did,
and there
was
some suggestion, and apparently the coroner was persuaded by it, that this could have actually given her more determination to get into this very, very small space, as you describe it. So
yes,
once again, an argument either way, just both of them just as convincing.
Exactly. That's true. However, there's a lot of evidence to show that the people who do funny things under the influence of Stilnox don't usually do anything they wouldn't normally do. Like, they clean the house, or they go for a drive, or they might go for a walk, but they don't normally get inspired to climb into a rubbish chute. Phoebe's death by rubbish chute is the first one of its kind in Australia. So it's pretty unique. It is unique.
On Life Matters, we're talking with Robin Bowles. She is the author of Into the Darkness, which is about the death of Victorian Phoebe Handsjuck. It's been published by Scribe. Now, we've talked briefly about Phoebe's family, but tell us about Anthony Hample. He's, at the time of Phoebe's death, he was 42. He was running an events company, but he comes from a very established Melbourne family.
So Ant's father is George Hample, QC. He is a very prominent jurist. He has probably been involved with almost every legal practitioner in Melbourne, either in his role as a barrister, in which case they would have briefed him, or in his role as a judge, in which case they would have presented cases to him, or in his role of professor of law at Monash, in which case he would have taught them. So it's very hard to find a barrister or lawyer in Melbourne who hasn't been involved in some way with George Hample. He's married to Felicity Hample, who is a practicing county court judge and Ant's stepmother.
Obviously, you know, well established in the legal fraternity.
Yes.
What about Ant himself? He's an events manager of sorts.
He is. Ant grew up going to an elite school, but he was very interested in the arts and in technology, and he eventually went to work for Gary Van Egmond's company. He's entertainment royalty in Australia and promoter. And then Ant left there and set up his own company called Alive Events. And that's what he was doing when he and Phoebe were together.
And in the last 6 weeks of Phoebe's life, you write that there had been some trouble in the relationship. There'd been separations. She had left the apartment a number of times. But they were very much in love.
Well, Phoebe's father, Len, thought when she and Ant got together that he was the one, with the capital letters, and that initially they were very close to each other, and they appeared to be very close in all the photos and so on that I've seen. But I think gradually they were drifting apart, and it was partly to do with Phoebe's drinking, I think. Ant has come across in the inquest as someone who did care about Phoebe and tried to help her with her battle with drinking and depression. So that's what he was telling the coroner. On the other hand, Phoebe, in the last 6 weeks, she actually left the house, their home, four times, packed a bag and left and went to visit relatives or friends and stayed with them for a number of days. But eventually, Ant always managed to persuade her to come home.
In those last few days of her life, she actually reached out to a lot of people that she had known in the past. She was making a lot of phone calls and meeting up with people, including one of the guys that she had gone to art school with.
That's right. This young guy, I called him Bob Gold in the book because he was very frank in the inquest and gave evidence that actually incriminated him, and the coroner gave him a what they call a letter of comfort so that he wouldn't be prosecuted for his evidence. But he and Phoebe had done quite a lot of drugs together at art school, and he was actually avoiding her because of her lifestyle later in the piece. But she contacted him and they got together and they had a day out together a few days before she died. And he was just one of the people in her phone directory, I think, that she was working through, basically wanting to be with people the whole time and not being alone in the apartment.
Mm. But the behaviour that she exhibited on that meeting was quite extreme. And in fact, at one point he restrained her.
Yes, that's correct.
And she was on the road playing a game of chicken with cars.
She was. She apparently he gave evidence that he picked her up at her apartment and then drove via a supplier that Phoebe had where she could buy some ecstasy tablets, and then she took one. And he didn't take one, but she did. And they went then to his house so he could show her some of his artwork. And the ecstasy kicked in. And yes, her behaviour was a bit outrageous. And she was out directing cars. And she was giving the cat a hard time, apparently, as well. And he eventually restrained her by pinning her down on the floor and saying, look, you know, I've got to stop. I'm going to take you home. And put her in his car. And then she leapt out of the car on the way when it was stopped, and nothing was seen or heard of her for 3 hours. Nobody knows where she went between that 9:30 departure from Ben until she came in about 12:30 to the apartment and Anthony was in bed. And so we don't know what happened in that time. And, you know, I've speculated in the book that maybe she met up with some people in that time that she had invited to the apartment subsequently, and on the day she died, maybe one of them had come by. It's very speculative. But if you don't believe that she put herself in the chute, which I don't, then there has to be another explanation, and that is still sitting out there.
But that's not what the coroner found. And
no.
The case, he didn't take the option of having an open finding. He did say it was misadventure. This means for the Handschuck family, that's kind of where it's left. Why is that?
Well, the thing is that if you have an open finding, if anything else comes to the attention of the police or others, the investigation can be reopened. But the way that it's been left now is that the investigation is ostensibly closed. If the family want to appeal that finding, which they did want to appeal it and still do, then they have to engage a barrister and take action in the Supreme Court. And the barrister that they spoke to said that they may have an outside chance on a point of law, which is the only grounds you can use to make an appeal against the coroner's finding. You can't say he made a mistake or extra information has become available. It can only be on a point of law. This barrister said, but I'm going to give you some good advice. And the advice is that the coroner will be represented, the police will be represented, and the Hample family will be represented. And if you lose, you'll be paying the fees of 3 QCs plus your own. And they couldn't afford to do it.
That'd be potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yes, exactly. Mm. And that pathway is closed to anybody who can't afford to seek justice in the Supreme Court. And I think that that's a mistake in the law. And it's not only in Victoria, it's in other states as well. And that ordinary people cannot afford to just up and go to the Supreme Court, and they might be able to afford to pay their own costs, but not everybody else's.
Robin Bowles, you've covered this case in tremendous detail in your book. I wonder, just finally, there is a great interest in the stories of true events and true crime, if that's what this might be or could be right around the world. But what are the chances, you know, in the end, that this is a simple suicide and a really grisly one at that? But what if it is just a suicide and there has been this attention and all these wounds being reopened time and again by the attention this case receives?
Good question. I think that, yes, wounds have been reopened. Len Handschuck hasn't been able to read my book. He's just looked at the cover. He's very supportive of the book, but he just can't bring himself to read it. Natalie Handschuck has had to go into a lot of detail, as has Lorne Campbell, to assist me over the last couple of years. And they've willingly done it, but it's been very painful for them. And I know that Aunt Hample told me that it was a very painful episode for himself, and that he's now hoping that the door was shut. But of course, my book does open a door again, not a special door, just a door. If it was a suicide, it was unique and very strange. And I don't actually say that it was a suicide in my book. I say that the finding should have been an open finding in case something else comes up in the future. Or even if it doesn't, the family would have the comfort of not believing that Phoebe actually deliberately put herself into that chute. They would have an open finding, which is much better for families than something where the person has contributed to their own death.
Well, who knows, one day maybe her memory will be able to rest in peace. Thank you very much for talking with us this morning, Robin.
Thank you, Cassie, for having me.
That's Robin Bowles. She is a true crime author. She's written a number of books, 13 of them all told. This latest one is called Into the Darkness, and it's about the death of Phoebe Handsjuck. And just a note, actually, RN will be airing the full series of podcasts by The Age about on our summer season about this case, and some more details that The Age journalists have discovered will be available then.